Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, black activists in Newark, New Jersey, launch demonstrations for social justice every day of the week for the next year. A challenge to black America to stand up for Zimbabwe. And hip-hop artist D-Noble takes you to the Terror Dome.
But first, even President Obama's harshest critics were appalled as he took the lead in offering savage cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, the crown jewels of the New Deal and the Great Society. Have the American people fully grasped what the Obama Republican cuts will mean to their daily lives? We asked Tony Montero, professor of African American studies at Temple University in Philadelphia.
I don't think the American public as a whole fully understands the situation. I think most people are deeply frightened and anxious about the situation because you have two things happening at once. On the one side, you have this right-wing bargain made between the Obama White House and the Congress that constitutes, as you put it, an assault upon the New Deal and the Great Society, upon the social contract that most Americans have taken for granted. So on the one side, you got that attack. On the other side, you have an economy that could easily go back into recession and maybe into depression, and could, as a consequence, drag most of the world down with it. So I think you got these two things going on. The attack upon the New Deal, which means unemployment, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, different forms of welfare. And on the other side, you have the possibility of another great recession, or maybe a Great Depression, where the people do not have any of the social supports to get them through.
In my adult lifetime, I have never observed such mass anxiety and unease as today.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't know that we have ever seen it in our lifetimes. People just don't know where to turn or where to go. And black folk and young people who invested so much in Obama are being betrayed in a way that they could have never imagined. And I think what we have to come up with is a political strategy that gets us through the 2012 election, but looks beyond the 2012 election. And that's what is on our plate at this moment.
President Obama has, for all time, associated himself with the assault on Social Security. What are the ramifications of that for the Democratic Party, as well as, of course, his own presidency?
The Democrats have a big problem. It seems increasingly difficult for Barack Obama to be reelected, on the one side. But even if he is reelected, if he is at the top of the ticket, it is very probable that he will bring the rest of the party down. I'm talking about the Republicans winning more seats in the House, the Republicans taking control of the Senate, and the Republicans winning gubernatorial, state House, and state Senate, and other statewide races all across this country. In other words, the country could become solidly Republican from the national government down to cities and states. This is the political debacle that his presidency has wrought.
And what you seem to be saying is that the only way the Democrats can save themselves is to jettison Obama.
Precisely. You know, what I've proposed in the past, and I'd like to propose it now, is, first of all, not that we leave it up to the party leaders to decide who will be the candidate, but that we encourage more progressive liberal Democrats to get into the nominating process. I would propose Russ Feingold out of Wisconsin, who lost in 2010 based upon a Tea Party attack upon him, as one liberal progressive Democrat who might run. I know if it's left up to the party leaders, they'll choose somebody like a Hillary Clinton. And I don't think that's the kind of change that we're looking for. The other thing is, I think we have to encourage the Green Party to field candidates. My dream Green Party ticket would be Cynthia McKinney and Kucinich. But we have to explore all of these possibilities in terms of the presidential race. But then when it comes to the fight for the Senate and the House of Representatives, we have to have a state-by-state strategy to defend the more liberal and progressive Democrats, to defeat the most reactionary Republicans. But I definitely believe that the party would go down to an ignominious defeat if Barack Obama heads the ticket.
But should the response to this crisis be simply an electoral one? What about the streets?
In talking about these third parties and talking about a Russ Feingold challenge within the Democratic Party, we're talking about the streets because these challenges have to be based upon a people's program. I mean, if Russ Feingold runs, he has to challenge the whole Obama so-called stimulus, the now we know $16 trillion bailout of these banks and major corporations that took place during the Obama, Bernanke, Geithner, Summers reign over the economy. That has to be challenged, as well as this austerity economy and these war policies. So I look upon this electoral thing as being enmeshed in a mass movement, and that would include also demonstrations, mass rallies, pickets, and so on.
The Democratic Leadership Council, which was the right wing of the party, the corporate bag man in the Democratic Party, put itself out of business earlier this year, and lots of people say, well, that's because they're in power. They don't need themselves. They're in the White House. But they are also in charge of the upper apparatus of the party itself. What you're advocating means a split in the Democratic Party, doesn't it?
Exactly. And there is already a split in the Democratic Party. As I understand, the Congressional Black Caucus split voting on this deal with the Tea Party that the Obama administration and the Republicans made. Half of them voted against, the other half voted for. The Progressive Caucus in Congress probably voted higher than that against it. Maybe 80% of them voted against it. If you get down to the state and local level, city councils, the mayors, state legislatures and stuff, you probably have more radical, more liberal, progressive elements who are prepared to fight against this austerity economy and this war economy.
But are they prepared to break with the nominal head of the party, the president?
Well, I'm suggesting that many of them have already done that. They may not have come out publicly and called for him to step down and not run, but I think that vote in the House of Representatives kind of suggests that. I understand about 90 Democrats voted against it. How far and what that no vote represents, we're not clear about. And the only thing that will decide that is what happens in the streets at the grassroots level. And I think growing anger, certainly fear, that will transform into anger as people lose their jobs, as people lose their unemployment insurance, as people lose their homes, as people lose the value of their homes, as students are unable to get Pew grants and other kind of loans and so on to go to college and so on. As this intensifies, the fear should rightly turn into anger, and hopefully the anger will turn into organization and mobilization.
That was Professor Tony Montero in Philadelphia.
Paul Street has written extensively on President Obama's brand of corporate politics. He's author of the book, The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama in the Real World of Power. Street points out that Obama put Social Security on the chopping block without the Republicans even demanding it.
Sterling moment. It's a very emblematic episode. just how far right this country has gone and continues to drift. I don't think it's an overnight thing. I think we've been drifting to the right steadily for decades now. But there is absolutely nothing won at all for progressive causes, precisely at a moment when progressive policy is desperately needed, when we have millions of people running out of the engine of the war and economic destitution. 1% of the population owns more than 40% of the wealth. We just had recent data about the wealth gap in this country, the racial wealth gap, the rising economic inequality in the wake of the Great Recession, whereby black median household net worth is now 1/20th of median white household net worth. We've got still continuing record foreclosures. We have the food pantries are bare in this country. We have historic high levels of food pantry usage. And the bonuses and the profits and the wealth of the opulent few are just continue to skyrocket. And here we have passed this so-called compromise, which makes it yet more impossible and unimaginable to conceive of the government doing anything to help anybody except the unelected dictatorship of money in this country.
Obama has always spoken of making some kind of big deals, finding a grand consensus with the Republicans, a grand consensus between labor and capital. Well, he looked for a grand consensus, and finally he got one. Can we assume that this is the kind of consensus he actually wanted?
At some point, he's got to kick in with, quote, you know, unquote, disappointed progressives. That this is not Obama caving in. This is not Obama surrendering. This is not Obama compromising his supposed progressive principles. I know he used the word progressive like 25 times in his book, Audacity of Hope, to describe himself, but that was just one of the many parts of his smokescreen to try and bamboozle liberals, leftists, and progressives into thinking that he's one of them, but he's not. I mean, this guy first got on the map and is known as an entity in the political culture of this country because he was the editor of the Harvard Law Review, and he got that position, we're going back in the 1980s here, precisely by cutting a deal with the far-right Federalist Society, the real right wing of the legal profession. And he ticked off a lot of progressives and the minorities within the Harvard Law. He was described early on as his Senate career began by a guy who knew him fairly well, the left political scientist, black radical Adolph Reed, as a vacuous to repressive neoliberal. Reed called him the wave of the future in black politics wherever the International Monetary Fund holds sway. And this was not just in the wake of looking at what his presidential career. This is how Reed described him and understood him in 1996 as his career was beginning. And he continued to be very good friends with Republicans in Springfield, Illinois, throughout his Illinois Senate career, cut all kinds of deals with the powers that be, and promised all of this. This is there's any number of ways that I could tell you about how this deal that was recently cut is very consistent with Obama's MO from the beginning. This, folks, is Barack. This is where he's coming from. He led off this process. He encouraged them to hold up this process with the debt ceiling deal in the first place. He could have preempted that from the beginning a long time ago. He opened the door for that. And then in response to the debt ceiling drama that he allowed them to have, he proposed regressive federal cuts that they weren't even talking about. He took the lead. He went ahead of anything they were even daring to ask for by calling for cuts in Social Security and Medicare early on. It's this so-called grand golf course bargain that he made in early July with John Boehner, the Republican Speaker of the House. This was what Obama's been about, really pretty much from the beginning, is Wall Street's guy. Not for nothing, but this guy set new records in campaign fundraising in 2008, and he set new records in raising money from Wall Street.
Has Obama finally exposed himself for all to see? Many of his critics like yourself and like us, have been accused of reading tea leaves and intestines to somehow divine what Obama was up to. Well, has he really showed his card? And
you think he has? And I have heard and seen more grumbling about him among progressives than I've heard in a long time, but I'm still astonished at the extent to which people are prepared to make excuses for him and to say that he's being boxed into a corner and to have the sense of him as being powerless in the face of all this fierce right-wing opposition. Somehow these 60 people in the House of Representatives, and I'm referring to the Tea Party caucus, they better come out with a Marvel Comics about these people, because they're more powerful than the Fantastic Four and Spider-Man and Captain America and all the rest of them combined. And somehow they had this superhuman power, according to the punditocracy and a lot of the political class, in and of themselves, you know, to just strap Barack Obama and John Painter in the back of a Thunderbird and drive it off the cliff in a game of chicken. I mean, I'm being sarcastic. You know, the fact of the matter is that these folks are as much following the wake of Obama as they are leading him. He's leading the charge on this. But, you know, you hear the strangest things from liberals willing to make excuses for Obama, like Lawrence O'Donnell in MSNBC went on TV a while back when the president was pushing this $4 trillion over 10 years of Social Security and Medicare cut, and said he didn't really mean it. This is what O'Donnell said. He really didn't mean it. He was just trying to show the Republicans that he's a deficit cutter, and he knew they wouldn't accept it. He's trying to paint them into a corner. That's a bunch of nonsense. Because after Boehner ended up projecting that deal, Obama went with a couple of other deals, including one from the so-called Gang of Six that included massive assaults on Medicare and Social Security. And this deal he's cut right now, the Democrats have, and this is one of the liberal defenses of him, well, he didn't have real big attacks on Social Security and Medicare. Well, they didn't need to. The Republicans know very well that they're going to have numerous shots at Social Security and Medicare starting in October as they start talking about the 2012 budget, and you can be absolutely 100% certain they're going to go after that and that Obama's going to cave and go along with that deal. And the other thing is they've set up this 12-member, 6 Republican, 6 Democrat bipartisan deficit reduction commission. The notion that that's the main problem in this country is deficit reduction instead of unemployment and poverty. And in a quite this deficit reduction commission, which will certainly come up with recommendations for significant cuts in what they like to refer to as entitlements. When they say entitlements, they mean Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Fascinating how they never mean the Pentagon, corporate welfare, and the various other sundry forms of subsidy and protection go to the very rich. The excuse-making goes on.
This 12-member super committee, as it's being called, would have powers never witnessed in the American legislative process.
Yeah, right.
And it is quite clear that progressives would be totally shut out from this very small appointed body.
You know, these so-called blue ribbon commissions, you know, and I'll tell you, Obama appreciates those from the Mayor Daley era. That's a classic mechanism for pretending to do something progressive. These things in the neoliberal era are famous for their right-wing results. This thing has a kick-in, automatic lock-in of significant regressive federal spending cuts if the commission's deadlocked or if the commission can't get support from Congress. One way they're gonna try and buy progressives in, so-called progressive, they'll get liberals on board, is claim that there's significant Pentagon cuts and claim there's significant defense cuts built into the trigger mechanism. In fact, this is smoke and mirrors. It's a statistical sleight in hand. What they're calling defense cuts are nothing more than sort of imaginary cuts based on projected future Pentagon growth rate. They're not actual real cuts.
Paul Street, author of The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama in the Real World of Power.
On August 20th, the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace and Reparations will hold an International Day of Action on the other wars, the ones the U.S. anti-war movement has historically ignored. But UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, has made a break with the past, endorsing the Black is Back Coalition's call. UNAC spokesperson Chris Gavreau explains.
A few weeks ago, we issued a statement welcoming the Millions March in Harlem, the many important meetings in the Black community. I've hosted Cynthia McKinney, organized around to oppose the bombing in Libya, to support the Black is Back call for August 20th, International Days of Action against the other wars, against African people, that is the wars on the African continent, Haiti, the mass displacement of Afro-Colombians, and, of course, the war on the Black community here at home. We also specifically urged our affiliates to begin to educate their ranks and the community about the impact of U.S. intervention on the African continent under the guise of AFRICOM via drone wars and CIA operatives in Somalia and via proxy wars in Congo. a conflict which has led to the largest civilian death toll of any war in human history.
Why has the anti-war movement, or much of it, historically had such a narrow view of what constitutes warfare?
The truth is that the U.S. anti-war movement really was born. Its major manifestation in U.S. history was the anti-Vietnam War movement. And if you think about when that movement occurred, it was in the wake of the McCarthy period, a very virulent anti-communist, anti-socialist campaign, and the sort of political right to protest against that specific war was one in struggle. Previously, the peace movement had been an anti-nuclear movement, one that never really named or challenged the specific wars the U.S. was fighting out of fear of red baiting and anti-communist sentiment. So when the Vietnam War happened, the movement was very conscious of opposing this one specific war and being able to explain what the struggle was really about in Vietnam, and to some degree treated it, many of the figures treated it as an aberration in U.S. foreign policy. It was deeply unpopular among youth and those that were being drafted, and so it was singled out as a safe war to protest eventually over time. So the U.S. anti-war movement has never been a broadly, quote, anti-imperialist movement that had an analysis of U.S. foreign policy in general. Historically, it was organized around specific wars where there were boots on the ground, where workers in uniform, soldiers were coming to understand the problems with the war, and so forth. So that's the history of the anti-war movement in the U.S. However, the last 10 years, I think there's been a dramatic change in the consciousness of those who build the anti-war movement on the ground, a giant leap in sophistication coming from observation of what the U.S. was doing in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and then understanding that interventions on the Horn of Africa, interventions in the Congo were about the same thing. So I think we're at a place where, on the one hand, greater numbers of people are prepared to understand that U.S. foreign policy is a whole and that interventions on every continent really are motivated by the same interest in defending U.S. corporate interest and elite corporate interest in a broader sense. But there's another factor as well, and I think it's this great recession where suddenly people understand that the White House and Washington is not going to defend them. And they see this giant corporate attack on working people from all communities. And it's hard to avoid the fact that this corporate attack, that the same people who are organizing this corporate attack in the U.S. are the ones promoting the wars abroad. And in addition, when one is under attack, one can more easily see the layers of the community they should look to for solidarity. And I think that there's a basis, a material basis, for a new kind of solidarity among the victims of the U.S. government, and that includes working people of all stripes. It includes especially Latinos facing massive deportations. And increasingly, I think more and more people are coming to understand that it must include the war on the black community, which has resulted in mass incarceration, that without unity of all those victimized in the U.S., we don't have a chance against this terrible government complicity in this corporate assault on our standard of living.
So UNAC is calling forth a new kind of anti-war movement.
UNAC recognizes that today you can't single out simply the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan, that we're building a movement in a nation of people intimately tied to the dreadful results of U.S. intervention all over the planet. Large Haitian communities, Muslim American communities, a black community that has deep emotional commitment and political solidarity with the struggles on the African continent, and that I don't believe there simply cannot be an anti-war movement that doesn't try to unify all these populations within the United States and come together around a common rejection of the main elements of U.S. foreign policy.
The Black Is Back Coalition says actions against the other wars will take place on August 20th in cities across the United States and in Toronto, London, and Nassau, Bahamas.
One of those who will speak at the Black Is Back New York event, a teach-in at Harlem's St. Mary's Church, is Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress in nearby Newark, New Jersey. Hamm's organization has launched a sustained action in Newark, inspired by the 1955 Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott that lasted 381 days. Already in its seventh week, it's called the Daily Campaign for Jobs, Peace, Equality, and Justice. Larry Hamm believes it may serve as a national model.
This is a daily protest. Usually our protests are periodic, weekly or monthly or annually. But this problem of unemployment in our community and its ramifications is so catastrophic that we felt that we actually had to ratchet up the pressure, so to speak. So we actually started discussing this idea back in January of 2011, and we finally decided in June that we would go forward with this effort because, you know, the members of People's Organization for Progress, we all working people, you know, jobs, families, the whole thing. So to commit to some type of daily campaign, that's a pretty big commitment and a pretty significant logistical feat for most people. You know, people come out to a demo once a month, maybe even once a week they'll do a vigil, but every day that's a lot to ask. But we felt that we had to do something to dramatize the seriousness of the situation. So we decided to move forward on this. The first day of protest was June the 27th. We have five basic demands. First is for the creation of a national jobs program with jobs at a living wage. The second is to end the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya, and to use that money for job creation at home. The third is a moratorium on home foreclosures. The fourth is for a universal health care program to provide health care coverage for all here in the United States. And the fifth is affordable college education for our young people. We want to end this process of indentured servitude of students. These students are coming out of college with $30,000, $40,000 worth of loan just for their undergraduate years. And it'll take years for them to pay this off. So we're saying affordable college education with grants and scholarship monies for students. And it's a basic program, and we kept it very basic so that the broadest number of people possible could unite with it. So we started these daily campaigns. We protest at the intersection of Springfield Avenue and West Market Street in Newark, New Jersey. There's a statue there of Abraham Lincoln, and we're right on the plaza in front of the Abraham Lincoln statue. This is a very visible spot in downtown Newark, and we're there every day with our big 6-foot black and white banners calling for jobs at a living wage. We're there every day from 4:30 to 6, Monday through Friday. And then we move the protest on Saturdays. We move it to the shopping area at Broad Market Street, and we're there from 2 to 4. And on Sunday, we return to the original location from 2 to 3. And we have decided, we have committed ourselves to continuing this campaign for 381 days. And the question is asked, why that number of days? Well, 381 days was the length of the Montgomery bus boycott, probably the most renowned protest and probably the most significant boycott, or one of the most significant boycotts in the history of the United States, when the black people of Montgomery, Alabama, united and decided they would not ride the Montgomery buses until segregated seating on those buses was ended. And 60,000 black people in Montgomery walked to work every day, and they finally broke the back of the Montgomery bus company, and Jim Crow on those buses was ended after the Supreme Court decision banning segregated interstate travel, and the campaign came to a victorious end 381 days after it began on December 1st, 1955, and everybody knows how it began with Sister Rosa Parks. So we said if our people back then, with far fewer resources and far less means of communication than we have today, could mount such an effort, that we should at least commit to doing the same, since we think this problem is a very serious problem in our community. So we're calling upon all organized entities throughout our area, throughout the state of New Jersey, and even throughout the country. We're calling on people to support us. And we're asking people who are members of churches and labor union locals and student organizations and grassroots community organizations, anybody that's in any kind of organized entity, be it even a block club or a sports group, a bowling team, whatever, we're asking people for each group to come and protest with us, to pick a day and bring your church or bring your union local or bring your club or bring your organization out on that day, pick a day during these 381 days and come and join us. And we think that if people do that, this could be one of the most significant protests we've had in our area in a long time.
People should know that the People's Organization for Progress has hundreds of dues-paying members in New Jersey. It seems that you've embarked on this sustained campaign to give agitation and protest a permanent place in the geography of Newark.
Absolutely. I mean, make no mistake about it. The object, the strategic goal of this protest is not just to highlight and draw attention to the problem of unemployment and to get our elected officials to take action on this, but really the main strategic objective is to heighten the political awareness and stir the masses of our people into action. We believe that what is required in this period is for people to get on the move for justice. The people in Wisconsin have showed the way with their sustained protests to protect workers and the right to collective bargaining. People in Egypt, in Tahrir Square, showed the way with their massive campaigns and massive protests on a daily basis. The people of Greece and other countries in Europe that are fighting these draconian austerity measures have shown the way with general strikes and other kinds of protests. Now it's time for our people who are suffering. So, you know, 10% is a depression level unemployment. We are now at 9.2% unemployment. We're just 0.8% away from depression level unemployment officially in the United States. But the black community has 18% unemployment nationally. That's almost twice the depression level, and that's the official rate. And then down here in Essex County, New Jersey, Newark is in Essex County, New Jersey, 20% unemployment in the county and 22% in the city of Newark, and in certain neighborhoods like the West Ward of Newark, a 30% unemployment rate, three times the depression level unemployment rate. So this is a catastrophe. It's a crisis. It's a state of emergency. And we believe that it requires the most potent action possible on the part of the masses of the people. I mean, we bailed out the bank. Now imagine that. We gave the people who already had the most money, we gave them more money. We gave them $1 trillion of our tax dollars to bail them out. The oil companies had the biggest profits in their histories, in the history of the United States, due primarily to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places around the world, record profits. And then the billionaires got billion-dollar tax breaks due to the Bush administration and then continued by the subsequent Congress and president. All the rich people are being taken care of. The few are being taken care of. It's now time to take care of the many. We have nearly 25 million people in this country unemployed, 16 million collecting unemployment benefits, probably as many as 10 million whose benefits are run out or are not even being counted. That's 25 million unemployed. Then we have millions more who are underemployed, who are working but are the working poor, who are just making enough money to get to basically feed themselves and get back and forth to work. That's really a form of slavery. So we have a real economic crisis in this country. There's a real economic injustice going on. Like I said, we gave the bankers $1 trillion, and then the Congress turned around and cut back on unemployment benefits. We gave money to the people that have money and then withheld money from people who need money. You know, it's crazy. And it's now time for the people to rise up and show their righteous indignation about this. And what we need not only to rise up, but we need sustained action now. Now we have to keep the pressure on it. It can't be one, it can't just be one big demonstration during the year. Of course, we should have, continue to have those big demonstrations. But what we need now is pressure every day of the year. Because if we don't do it, we will all be living in the streets before this thing is over.
So you're saying if a people are already living in a state of emergency, they ought to act like it.
That's right. That's right. I mean, all you have to do, you go to Newark, New Jersey, come down to Penn Station in Newark, New Jersey, you will see the homeless people sleeping down there. There's no more room in the homeless shelters. You go to communities like Irvington, New Jersey, you will see whole blocks of houses boarded up, of homes that went into foreclosure in the last 24 months. In the last 24 months in America, 2 million people have lost their homes, and 1 million of them were black families that lost their homes. You know, and then what did the grateful bankers do for our trillion dollar American tax dollar bailout? What did they do in gratitude for all that money we gave them? What did they do? They turned around and raised their credit card rates. They raised their checking account and saving account rates. They raised the interest on their loans to small businesses. And they foreclosed on homes. Here in Newark, New Jersey, and in Essex County, we have the highest rate of foreclosure in the state. And then you have other places like Baltimore, Maryland, where whole neighborhoods were closed up as a result of these crazy financing deals that Wachovia and Wells Fargo and these other companies did in these communities. So we're in a state of emergency. We're in a national crisis, and we have to begin to respond in a way that begins to bring about change. I'd just like to say that if people want more information, or if they're ready and they want to pick a day that they're going to come out and stand with us. I mean, individuals can come out and stand with us, but we want organizations to come out too. They can contact the People's Organization for Progress at 973-801-0001. That's 973-801-0001. And for more information, they can go to our website at www.njpop.org. Or they can look us up on Facebook, facebook.com/People's Organization for Progress.
Larry Hamm speaking from Newark, New Jersey.
The Association of Black Psychologists held their national convention just outside Washington. One of the symposiums took a wide-ranging look at the concept of African sovereignty. Hip-hop artist D. Noble provided the context.
Welcome to the Terror Dome, where they say I'm too militant just cause I craft with belligerent penmanship. Every time I open my lips, my vocals equip proletariat hearts with thoughts of vengeance. My art compels slaves to struggle for independence, so the state now wants to suffocate my resistance. But I'm a defiant rebel. I breathe, feel my lungs contract and expand as I demand autonomy for a subjugated colony of black refugees socialized to be property. The philosophies of white supremacy should make us all public enemies, but we be addicted to capitalism's flavor of lust. And it's so delicious, we just keep turning cheeks. Black ass been no sale, and most y'all ain't got no receipt. Welcome to the Terror Dome, where black bodies and black faces are rapidly erased from post-industrial spaces. Rats and roaches overtake us in urban flats that trap and break us. Taxes rape us, mountains of debt slay us. Life is Goliath, and our paltry wages are David's, and we can't even afford a slingshot to save us. Welcome to the Terror Dome, where the middle passage turned gods to baggage. We went from deities to chattel beasts to burdens to despised wage earners, and now we slave on corporate plantations and think of disease ain't like Jesus for these oppressed nations. An air-conditioned condition of a slave master system that we to submit to without the protest of a spiritual, let alone a Nat Turner, because now we salaried earners, and we done been pimped and whipped for so long over time, we don't even mind the extra hours grind without a dime of overtime. Welcome to the Terror Dome, where black flesh is stretched thin over barbed wired bones, native tongue capsized in a tirade of moans, spirit on loan to inanimate machines, nightmares are nurtured while we bury stillborn dreams, survival ends in overtaxed screams, aimless beings marauded for their humanity, walk a tightrope between capital and sanity, glass ceilings have become more important than family, when you realize that promotions are just vanity, maybe then you will question, what does life demand of me?
That was hip-hop and spoken word artist D. Noble.
Dr. Jared Ball also addressed the Association of Black Psychologists. Ball teaches communications at Morgan State University and is an editor and columnist at Black Agenda Report.
Colonialism demands the permanence of propaganda. If you can control the popular culture, the popular image, it doesn't matter how many Brother Nobles you can produce on a mixtape or at a conference. Overwhelmingly, he will be judged by the norm that has been established by the nonsense that they promote on a daily basis. And just if you're not aware of it, just very quickly, to get on the radio or television, you have to pay. You have to pay a lot of money, about $1,000 per song per station to get on that top rotation around the nation, which means that your song is played every hour on the hour all around the country every day, to the point where one song is getting 5,000 to 7,000 to 8,000 spins per week all around the country. This makes it impossible for people to have even just the time to hear somebody like a Brother Noble or the many women and men of his caliber who are just suppressed and left to wallow in the margins. And then it's just even more of a spit in the face when people who claim that they know about hip-hop and politics to get out publicly and just disparage all of rap music and disparage all of black youth, even while they claim to be representing them. And it's really offensive. In a way, as Marshall McLuhan said, that developing us as creating us as the fish who do not know who discovered water, because an all-pervasive environment is always beyond perception. So we are subsumed within this media environment. We are developed within it and don't necessarily always recognize what it's doing to us or that it even exists. And they recognize this because they said that media and communication needs to be understood as weaponry, the fourth arm of the military, as in fact they said, and that it has the impact of atomic bombs, as they said. We see our ability to communicate against others as a weapon, as a bomb, as an atomic bomb to destroy their ability to resist what we're doing. Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was an advisor to Obama, said the same thing in 1997. He said that our ability to maintain, meaning our, the United States, ability to maintain itself as an empire is only because we control popular entertainment and mass communication around the world, including the internet. And this is what allows us to survive as an empire, unlike the previous ones that didn't have that ability. So if we're waiting for this thing just to collapse, and when people talk about America's downfall, I get a little suspicious because of their control over communicative networks around the world. And then just very lastly, our own media work and our own journalism needs to reflect that, because media and journalism reflect the political consciousness and organization of a community. So when we're talking about the images that we get imposed upon us, and when we talk about our inability to promote versions of ourselves that are more realistic and supportive of our revolutionary aspirations, it is because we are not politically organized. We can't wait for media to change and then we'll change because of it. We have to politically organize to impose that change on media and journalism, which is exactly what happened. If we go back and put a friendly face on this Obama returning us 50 years, it's exactly what happened that allowed for so much of the radical organization to occur and them to produce their own radical media and communication that supported their political development, their organization, and ultimately make some change, which required those in power to neo-colonially promote versions of us and give slight access to a handful of us so that we would have to, again, cyclically engage the struggle, which is what I'm clear that we are here to do. So as Fred Hampton used to say, to you we say peace, and we'll add, those who want peace and sovereignty, of course, have to fight for it. And thank you very much.
Dr. Jared Ball is author of the new book, I Mix What I Like, A Mixtape Manifesto.
Obi Egbuna urged the black psychologist to reject all the hostile propaganda about Zimbabwe and its president, Robert Mugabe. Egbuna is the U.S. correspondent for The Herald, Zimbabwe's state newspaper. He says Zimbabwe's success is black America's success.
Zimbabwe is authentic homeland security and defense. Zimbabwe's land and mining programs boost reparations, efforts to fight gentrification, the plight of our farmers. Zimbabwe's breakthrough in education boosts our efforts for affirmative action, saving HBCUs, defending the integrity of African independent schools. Zimbabwe's history of women's empowerment changes our social and political landscape. Zimbabwe exposes the attempts by imperialism to reestablish domination of Africa using symbols of our resistance, neocolonialism in the name of labor, in the name of women's rights, and in the name of students' rights. Zimbabwe teaches us outsiders do not determine who we embrace and reject. Zimbabwe helps us against the fight with military repression and violence and how we can make that struggle come full circle. Those are the things I'm going to touch on very quickly. I was asked some questions to touch on in the presentation. What is President Mugabe's vision for African people? What is the Western and U.S. response to Zimbabwe and the plight for African power and sovereignty? And, of course, some recommendations, because we must not let our liberation struggle be reduced to one big giant opinion fest. First of all, unapologetically, Zimbabwe must become for Africans what Palestine is for Arabs, what Cuba and Venezuela are for Latin Americans, a rallying point to unify no matter where we are on what Christians call God's green earth, because of the genuine resistance. We learned from the overthrow of Osagyefo Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana one thing. We must not let our former colonial and slave masters divert attention away from our most positive and uplifting attributes. Zimbabwe has a 97% literacy rate. Anyone in this room committed to education like you are, that has to raise your eyebrows. Zimbabwe, all the way going back to Mbuya Nyahanda, the first spirit medium to launch the first armed revolt against the British. In Zimbabwe, the noose is a symbol of resistance. So we were telling our young people during Gina 6, if they put the noose around our neck, we'll say what Nyahanda said, Mfupa Angu Achumuka, my bones will rise through the fighting spirits of my people, and eventually we will defeat you on the battlefield. It's a symbol of resistance there, all the way to Sally Mugabe, who isn't even Zimbabwean, President Mugabe's first wife. She was Ghanaian. You're talking about the Underground Railroad. You're talking about, as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Riders, she leaves independent Ghana, goes into colonial Rhodesia, organizes the women, using Nkrumah's definition, the best way to measure the degree of a people's revolutionary awareness is by the political maturity of the women. And her political maturity led her from free Ghana into battle-contested Rhodesia, and they defeated the second most powerful colonial army colonialism put on the African continent. Zimbabwe helps us understand all genuine resistance must be embraced. We can talk about positive action. We're proud of it. This is the 50th anniversary of Lumumba's assassination, one of the giants when it comes to that aspect of our resistance. We can talk about Nkrumah and his positive action, but we're not going to back away from Africans who won their independence through guns. Not going to do it. Because as long as it was genuine, and as long as the targets were the appropriate targets, and as long as our marksmen and markswomen were accurate, no problem with the guns. When we come to deal with this question, what is President Mugabe's vision for African people? I'll tell you what he told me, and this is for you. When I had the honor and privilege of meeting him in 2003 for the first time, he told me Africans in the United States have a very romantic and sensationalized view of Africa. He said, you talk about coups, you talk about assassinations, but you pay very little attention to the efforts by imperialism to isolate a country to make them vulnerable for a coup, vulnerable for an assassination. So when those who have accepted the Democratic Party's interpretation of democracy as gospel And I'm talking to a community who practices Christianity on the surface, votes Democrat religiously, and wants to pay your bills and taxes on time till you die in this cesspool of exploited labor. So you know what I'm talking about. I don't have to translate it. Mm-mm. And you say he's been in power too long. This is what you say when you're by yourself. So I ask you, you should celebrate that, like Christians celebrate Jesus walking on water or turning water to wine. Because he didn't end up like Amilcar Cabral in a pine box after only 4 years in power, or Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso after 4 years in power, or Patrice Lumumba after only 6 months in power. He's been in power for 31 years. And if you're and what people are really doing is questioning the authenticity of the democratic process in Zimbabwe. They've had more elections than any country in modern African history, like clockwork. And they're now developing another constitution to expedite the process more. They have modern Africa's first woman vice president, Amaia Joyce Mujuru, and it was her appointment to that position that created the atmosphere for Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to become the president of Liberia. And she's the youngest African woman in modern history to serve in a parliament in Africa at the age of 24. And we celebrate her not only for that, she was the highest-ranking woman guerrilla during the second Chimurenga. She shot down the first British warplane, and she's vice president right now. So you should include her in your Rolodex of women you embrace for all the sisters in here. You have to. So when we talk about these positive attributes, in my capacity, people will tell me all the time, and Jarrett can tell you, oh, brother, they going to start saying, accusing you of hero worship. You love President Mugabe too much. No different than Stokely Carmichael changing his name to Kwame Ture to show his love for Nkrumah and Ture. No different than Fidel Castro saying that Jose Marti is the apostle of the Cuban Revolution. No different than Barack Obama swearing himself in with Abraham Lincoln's Bible. Not at all. So when we come to deal with these things, the land reclamation program, 350,000 families in a country that has six people have land in Zimbabwe. That boosts any movement we have on a pan-African scale for some type of land empowerment. Zimbabwe has the distinction of being the only country accused of blood diamonds, where there is no warfare and there is no military conflict. You know why? Because they now have 25% of the world's diamond reserves, and they're going to use the diamonds to bust the sanctions. I come here tonight to tell you one thing. We are the 10th anniversary of the Zimbabwe Democracy Economic Recovery Act, U.S. imperialism's vindictive response to the land reclamation program in Zimbabwe. It's approaching the 10th anniversary. We're not going to let it get 50 years old like the blockade in Cuba coming up next year. And many of you have a very distorted view of military repression. Your view reflects an episode of G.I. Joe. Guns make you mad. Bombs make you mad. They starve people to death when they can't impose their will on them every single day. 2 million people in Iraq dead for Madeleine Albright sanctions. The blockade on Cuba, the monstrous blockade on Cuba that we must fight to lift, has cost Cuba $97 billion. That could be more doctors they send to Africa, more doctors they send to Haiti. Building a fortress of solitude around Asada Shakur, and she needs to have one. So we talk about this aspect, and every member of this Congressional Black Caucus voted in favor of these sanctions, in your name, because you voted for them. And the five that didn't, guess what? They abstained. 9 white Republicans voted against these sanctions, and 2 white Democrats. Let me give you the breakdown of this administration's relationship to Zimbabwe. Johnny Carson, the spokesperson of this administration in Africa, highest-ranking African in the National Intelligence Council, never heard of it. Truman created it to give the CIA strategic direction. Joe Biden, co-sponsor of the Zimbabwe Democracy Economic Recovery Act. Hillary Rodham Clinton, co-sponsor of the Zimbabwe Democracy Economic Recovery Act. The ambassador to the UN, Susan Rice, got her PhD on Zimbabwe. President Barack Obama has extended sanctions against Zimbabwe 3 years in a row, and it's not something he inherited. When he was a senator, he wrote Bush a letter in 2007, don't lift the sanctions on Zimbabwe until the dark cloud of Robert Mugabe's been ousted of power. He better stick to dealing with John Boehner and these white Republicans as Democrats and Republicans continue their lover's quarrel. Robert Mugabe is way out of Barack Obama's league. So when we come to talk about this issue, these sanctions must be lifted. I'm calling on the National Association of Black Psychologists to join the effort to lift these sanctions on Zimbabwe. Build a bridge with Zimbabwe. We're developing an educational project called Merging Our Experiences, which will enable you to connect to 5 other Southern African countries. That can be the way you contribute to Zimbabwe. Help their AIDS work, because before sanctions, matter of fact, in Southern Africa, they have the most significant decline against HIV/AIDS in Southern Africa. They had the best cholera tracking system in Africa, the most effective net rollout program against malaria. All these positive attributes being undermined because of these sanctions. So this is your fight. And as President Mugabe says about Zimbabwe, our cause is Africa's cause. I'll end like I began. Zimbabwe must become for Africans what Cuba is for Venezuela, Cuba and Venezuela are for Latin Americans, and what Palestine is for Arabs. And this one real quickly, and then we must ask the question, what hurt Zimbabwe more? As people celebrate the 100th anniversary of Reagan, him reneging on the Lancaster House agreements, or Carter, who's posing as the savior of the Palestinians as we have this conversation, and Al Gore posing as the face of a world environmental movement, we must ask ourselves, what hurt Zimbabwe more? White liberals procrastinating on making things right with Lancaster, or white conservatives being arrogant and blatantly disrespectful, seeking regime change in Zimbabwe? Zimbabwe forever, sanctions never. Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my colleague Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Giselle Hernandez.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.